This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We all know the mad retail rush in the weeks and months leading up to holidays. Halloween and Easter sales fund the candy industries for the entire year. And Thanksgiving marks the official beginning of Christmas doorbusters. Even Passover ignites a buying frenzy in cities like L.A. and New York. So where are all the Ramadan specials? With the Muslim population slated to rise to 6.2 million by 2030, American businesses can no longer afford to neglect that huge market and consumer base any longer. Tanya Basu joined us last Ramadan after her article, "Why Are There So Few Ramadan Marketing Campaigns?" appeared in The Atlantic. So I just touched on the demographic, but let's break it down, this potential customer base retailers are missing out on. What is the makeup of Muslim American families in age and income, for example?
Right. So it seems like the Muslim population is growing in the U.S., and it's actually going to be the largest outside of the Middle East, except for Russia and France. So the U.S. is projected to have a huge Muslim population, and it doesn't seem like there's too many advertisers paying attention to it just yet, though they are starting to, and that's because many of them are between the ages of 18 and 39, which is the so-called millennials, and they are a huge demographic in terms of purchasing power, since they're about as well off as the average American household. And additionally, they're the country's second most educated religious group, which means that they're getting jobs in white-collar positions that are paying very well and are they're therefore able to purchase a lot more. So in demographically, they're kind of a dream demographic.
So why then have marketers been steering clear of advertising directly to Muslim populations, especially for something like Ramadan?
It's kind of a twofold thing. Some people that I talked to didn't want to come out and say that it was racism, but they did point to Islamophobia, especially in a post 9/11 environment. And many of them were actually affected by the Whole Foods issue, which basically in 2011, Whole Foods started a Ramadan campaign, was the first brand in the U.S. to do so. And they were met with a slew of bigoted emails and a response from some members of the community who wanted products that were promoted for Ramadan to be taken off shelves. So a lot of marketers are not exactly, they're not racist or anything, but they don't necessarily want to have anything associated with being anti-American per se, and I say that in quotes. So that's an issue that a lot of people don't want to come out and say, but that is definitely a problem in marketing. And a second problem is that a lot of people are not exactly educated about Ramadan. So people think these people are fasting all day and then they're eating at night. So what's the point of marketing to them? And they don't realize that a lot of the holiday is actually sort of comparable to Christmas in terms of you're buying a lot of gifts for family members. You are buying food, but you're also buying things for yourself that you might not necessarily buy during the rest of the year. So there's an entire merchandise market that can be taken advantage of during this time of year. And I think a part of it is definitely an education issue in terms of what people understand about the religion and the holiday itself.
Let's go back to this backlash at Whole Foods in 2011. It was working with a company called Saffron Road for the most part, a company which uses only products sourced from sustainable, family-owned farms. And they were promoted for Ramadan by Whole Foods, which of course is an upscale supermarket here in the U.S. How did it affect sales?
So that was a surprising thing. I talked to Adnan Durrani, who is the founder of the company, And he said their sales went up 500% during that promotion, which is huge. I mean, for basically a startup company. And Durrani was even telling me that actually many of its customers from their studies weren't even Muslim. They were actually just members of the community who were interested in the fact that here's a product line that is sustainable, that's anti-GMO, that is organic. And that in itself is something remarkable in terms of the fact that the Muslim advertising campaign does not necessarily have to be focused purely on adherence to the Islamic faith. It can also be so broad as to welcome in people of other faiths, of other demographics. And I think that was a really big lesson that Whole Foods learned from Saffron Road. And they've been able to try to incorporate that into their marketing campaign since. And they've been doing pretty well, actually, since then.
So sales went up 500% for that one company. Obviously, it's working. And the global marketing giant Ogilvy & Knorr has set its sights on the Muslim American population in the U.S. So what is its strategy?
They're trying to not necessarily focus on food. They're looking at alternative products. So fashion, I actually initially got this idea from seeing this ad in DKNY for their Ramadan line, which is very interesting in terms of trying to combine modern fashion sense and a modern aesthetic with their requirements of Islamic dress.
Mm-hmm.
So DKNY has done a pretty decent job at marketing for that. I'm not exactly sure about their sales, but they got a lot of social media attention after they put out that marketing campaign. And I also mentioned the story about this really cool company, Inglot, which is creating a water-permeable nail polish. And that's really important because Muslim women cannot have anything on their hands when they worship. And this is kind of going around that legally by creating a water-permeable nail polish, which is completely fine by Islamic standards and allows these women to paint their nails and just be a normal girl during these times. So a lot of these companies are being extremely creative in how they're marketing to Muslims and creating products that allow them to practice their faith while also being American. And I think that is kind of the sweet spot for a lot of these marketers. They're looking for this product that allows these people to maintain their American identity while also allowing these people to continue practicing their faith.
So it requires businesses to know something about the culture that they are marketing to, obviously. Any historical precedent and also, I don't know, landmines. I mean, if you are a company who says, oh, I'm going to start marketing to Muslim Americans, there's a big market there. Couldn't there potentially be some sort of suspicion or even backlash to making a buck just because a demographic is growing and there's a potential market there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people I spoke to were actually hesitant about expanding sales to Muslim Americans, and they were Muslim American themselves because they were looking at this as, we're starting to commercialize our religion. Is that necessarily a good thing? And a lot of people have complained about that with regards to Christmas, for example, where the holiday itself kind of loses its meaning in the commercialization of it.
Kind of does.
All those gifts and buying and purchasing sprees. But I think a lot of people are actually looking forward to having Ramadan recognized by marketing campaigns and stores and brands because it provides an education implicitly of the religion, especially post 9/11 when a lot of people had, I wouldn't say Islamophobia, but definitely had concerns about Muslims in general. This is a great way for them to educate them, other people, about the holiday and what it entails and the fact that, hey, we're Americans too. We eat, we have fun, we dress up, we do things that you guys do, we just have a different faith. And that's something that I think is inherently American. I mean, marketers have been doing this for years in terms of trying to reach out to different demographics. I'm thinking about Kwanzaa, for example. I mean, that was not a huge holiday, even when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. But it's starting to be something that a lot of marketers are paying attention to because there's this demographic of people who, I mean, they have this purchasing power that they're able to practice. And if you can actually personalize the shopping experience for these people while not alienating others, that is a sweet spot of marketing in terms of capturing an audience who you might not have otherwise marketed to, and able to increase your business and have potentially an entire group of people who will be purchasing your products for now and into the future.
Tanya Basu, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Tanya Basu is former editorial fellow for The Atlantic. She now works as a reporter for Time. You'll find a link to read her article, Why Are There So Few Ramadan Marketing Campaigns, at wordofmouthradio.org. One of the world's largest brands jumped into the Ramadan marketing business this year. Coca-Cola released a special limited edition can in their Middle Eastern markets in honor of the month-long holiday. The iconic red can sports the signature wavy line, but instead of the Coca-Cola logo, there's a simple message printed on the side. Labels are for cans, not for people. In a statement, Coca-Cola said the special cans are an effort to promote a world without labels and prejudices. A noble pursuit, but we'd like to know what you think. Is this a step in the right direction or a misguided attempt to capitalize on a religious holiday? Let us know what you think on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ramadan is observed by Muslims worldwide as a month of fasting from dawn until dusk during the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. Islamic tradition says to end the fast once the new crescent moon is seen. However, if you search online for the end of Ramadan, you'll quickly discover that this year it ends on July the 17th. This is because some Muslims have been using a different method to calculate the end of Ramadan that does not involve staring up at the sky. Producer Hanna Baba brings us the story.
About 20 Muslim families are gathered on a hilltop outside the Lawrence Hall of Science in Berkeley. It's just after sunset. A large fountain bubbles nearby. Women and men chat, and kids run around with snacks in their hands. And everyone, at some point or another, looks up to the sky.
Mommy, look, I'm on the tail!
These families are moon sighting, looking for the new crescent moon that will mark the beginning of the month of Ramadan. Every year, they gather here to fulfill a centuries-old tradition from the Prophet Muhammad, who said, "Fast when you see it, and break your fast when you see it," meaning the new moon. If they see it, they'll start the fast tomorrow. If they don't, the fasting will begin on the next day. Zareen Zoja Malik is standing close by in a warm-looking overcoat. I ask her if she's ever spotted the new crescent moon.
I have. I've sighted the moon at this spot. It was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, mashallah. We actually seen the crescent. We're all so excited to see it. So,
not everyone, though, is uncertain about the start of Ramadan. About an hour south of the Berkeley Hills lies the Muslim Community Association, or MCA, a mosque in Santa Clara. It's in the midst of Silicon Valley, minutes away from tech giants like Yahoo, Cisco, and Apple. MCA congregants knew exactly when they would start their fast, months ago. How? They use astronomical calculation, science, to mark the start of the month. The MCA's Tariq Murad explains that the Quran urges Muslims to think, learn, and discover. And it helps, he says, when you're in innovative surroundings.
And so you have to embrace science when science shows you something and understand what it is. And that's why, for me, calculation is important, and so is being in a place like the Bay Area where we push the envelope with science.
5.597661 days plus.
This is the equation used to calculate when the new moon will emerge. The person reading it is Walt Ogburn, research associate at Stanford's Physics and Cosmology Department. He says this equation tells us when the new moon will come out every month, forever.
And so you can just plug in whichever month you want, for starting from the year 2000, and find out exactly when, at what time on which day the new moon will be. And this is something that you can use to predict the time of the new moon for centuries and centuries out, and it'd be very precise.
Muslims using scientific calculation to mark Ramadan are following a recent fatwa, or edict, issued by the Fiqh Council of North America, or FICNA, a body that makes Islamic legal decisions for an American context. FICNA director Muzammil Siddiqui says this newer method removes the uncertainty that often comes with moon sighting.
The objective is not to see the moon. The objective is to make sure that the new month has come. And that objective is better fulfilled through scientific knowledge. Even if you see by your own eyes, sometimes you may miss the moon, or you may see something different and you can think that it was moon.
And Siddiqui says there are many advantages to calculating. Most importantly, there's now a set calendar, making it easier to do things like reserve party halls for the post-Ramadan festival. And that's not all.
People can inform, get time off from their offices. Students can take time off from their school.
Okay, now before you go thinking, this just sounds like another clash between science and religion, UC Berkeley Islamic history professor Asad Ahmed says, not so fast. Islam, he says, has a rich scientific tradition, including astronomy. European astronomers of the 15th and 16th centuries, like Galileo and Copernicus, were building on the works of 8th century Muslim astronomers.
Yeah, historically, Muslim scholars would generally be trained in a curriculum that included many disciplines, including astronomy and logic and philosophy and philosophical theology and mathematics and so on and so forth.
So why then does it seem that some Muslims are shying away from astronomical calculations today? One explanation is that people sometimes felt astronomy was too close to astrology, which is shunned by Islam as mumbo-jumbo. Whatever the reasons, Professor Ahmed says, what's important today is to be careful about how we frame these differences in opinion.
The differences should not be made into those who are modern on the one hand and who believe in science and believe in astronomy, and those who do not.
The practical result of there being two methods, moon sighting and calculation, is that people often get differing outcomes. While calculators predict the new moon on one day, the moonsiders won't go by that unless they see the moon. That's meant people starting their fasts on different days from others, and therefore celebrating the end of their fasts on different days as well. The unity of fasting together as a Muslim community is thrown off, and that's something many Bay Area Muslims agree needs fixing. Atop their Berkeley Hill, the moonsiders are still looking upwards after the evening prayer. An hour has passed, and they realize it's too foggy to see the moon, even if there is one. I approach a man named Bilal al-Habashi, who's surrounded by kids.
So what's the verdict today?
Yeah. The verdict today, what did you guys say? Did you see it? Did you see the moon?
No.
Okay, did you see the moon?
No.
Did you see the moon?
No.
So what do you say? We fast tomorrow?
No.
Why?
Because we didn't see the moon.
But the calculations say there was a new moon that night, so scores of other Muslims did indeed fast the next morning. Bilal al-Habashi has a name for people who follow each method, and he says both are just fine in Islam's eyes.
So you're encouraged to be a digital Muslim, and you're encouraged to be an analog Muslim. Whatever gets you good.
Al-Habashi uses humor to soften the tension of heated discussions around this subject.
We usually have, last 40 years, we have like the song Kung Fu Fighting, we have moon fighting. So when I came in, I said, hello, brothers, moon fighting? Moon fighting or moon sighting? And it was a joke, and everybody laughed. And then I said, so, you know, try to be good to them, you know?
As we prepare to leave the moon sighting party, I walk up to the imam of Oakland's Lighthouse Mosque, Sundiata Rashid, who stands surrounded by his wife and kids. I ask him if perhaps he'd consider calculating next year.
Myself, I like the local sighting, but I like the unity of the Muslims even more. So if everybody agreed to go with a calculation, I'd be fine with that. But until they do, I'm just going to keep sighting the moon.
While they may not agree, the moonsighters and calculators have the same goal, to complete a month of fasting, reflection, and togetherness.
And that story came to us from the producer, Hannah Baba.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Television is dead. Long live television. While the internet has gouged profits at newspapers and movies and magazines and books and big music labels, except, of course, for Taylor Swift, a new golden age of TV continues to hit its stride. Breaking Bad and Mad Men may be over, but prestige dramas are still rolling out on Showtime and HBO. We've got binge-worthy original series on Hulu and Netflix, a revival in late-night programming, and the three big networks are still making shows that incite passionate followings, even if the ratings aren't always so hot. So depending on whom you ask, audiences are splintering fast and TV is gasping its last breath or experiencing some kind of revival. With us to talk about the state of TV today is Felix Gillette from Bloomberg Businessweek. Hello, Felix.
Hi.
Also with us, Boston Globe TV critic Matthew Gilbert returns to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi there. And New York Times TV editor Gilbert Cruz. Hello, Gilbert.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, and very excited to talk about this because I think it is confusing for a lot of people. So much going on in television, so much to watch, certainly. And now we have Upfront Week behind us. Now, that's the week that traditionally the networks unveil their new shows and new schedules. So outside of TV critics, was anyone really watching?
No. I feel like it's only in the past few years that the upfronts have even become a thing that most people pay attention to. I mean, sort of TV, hardcore TV fans pay attention just because they want to see trailers of the new shows. So, you know, the trailer for Supergirl or the trailer for the new John Stamos sitcom. But it is still, it's still an industry-heavy thing. I mean, upfronts are made for advertisers, and that's what that week was for. But there was a buzz coming out of that week about certain shows that I think the networks are going to try to expand upon in the next few months up to the week of September 21st when all these big shows start premiering.
That was Gilbert Cruz. And Gilbert, we're going to pick up on some of those new shows later. What do you got, Matthew?
Well, I think over the years, as the networks have become more and more desperate, the upfronts have also become a sort of opportunity to introduce the kind of promotion of the fall shows. It's absurdly early. It's hard for me to believe that people actually remember from May to September which shows are coming and where. But the networks have really turned the upfronts into quite an event. The titles, the stars, who's going to be, you know, on this fall.
Yeah, I sort of remember this time with the depressing clod of the back-to-school catalogs reaching our front doorstep. But, you know, they roll out the schedules then. They tell us which day things are going to be on in many cases. Does scheduling still matter in the day of on-demand television?
That's a great question. Because the Nielsen ratings are no longer as dependable as they used to be, if they ever were, because of all of the platforms that people are watching TV on, it's really hard to say how much scheduling can sort of cajole somebody into watching a show.
This is Felix. I think that scheduling matters a lot if you have live programming. Sports, you know, women's soccer competing for the World Cup, then, you know, that's an opportunity where people will tune in at a certain time in a certain place to your network. Otherwise, I think it's getting increasingly hard, especially for younger audiences, to motivate them to show up to your network on their schedule.
Well, Felix, you made the point that in your article about Viacom, you know, there's been this shift, of course, to nonlinear, to on-demand TV. But still, collectively, pay TV is currently in an unprecedented rating slump. Now, why is that so important, especially for Viacom? Or why is Viacom so hard hit by that?
Well, I think Viacom's been hard hit by it, in large part because they are so heavily concentrated in cable programming that targets young audiences. So if you look at their networks, Nickelodeon, MTV, Comedy Central, Spike, these are networks, VH1, that tend to target, you know, everything from kids to teenagers to young adults. And I think those are the audiences that have been abandoning linear television faster than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. But there's still some appeal to much wider audiences. You know, the name of your article was Nobody Wants Their MTV. What is it? I Don't Want My MTV.
Why Nobody Wants Their MTV, yeah.
Why Nobody Wants Their MTV. Which, by the way, does anyone else feel a little pang of nostalgia for the MTV that was?
I definitely do. I mean, I think it's amazing how successful MTV has been over the years at reinventing itself for new waves of teenagers. I just think that, you know, when you think back to the 80s when MTV arrived on the scene, they had that teenage audience to themselves, and the branding was amazing. I mean, when I was a teenager, I didn't tune into MTV to see particular shows. You just tuned in to watch MTV, which was an incredible business model for them. And I think that now there's just so much competition for teens and their time and their entertainment media time. I mean, YouTube, Netflix, Hulu, in addition to things like Instagram, Twitch. I mean, there's just the whole landscape has fragmented. So part of MTV's current struggles, you can't exactly blame them for. I mean, I think there are things that are unique to their own struggles currently that are part of their problem with not being able to create hit programming. But it's also certainly related to this change in the landscape as a whole.
Well, that's another question I want to put to all of you. You know, is there still a target audience for television?
I think it depends on the network. I mean, and this sort of relates to your question about scheduling. I mean, there are many networks, both cable and terrestrial, that where scheduling really doesn't matter. But then you look at a place like CBS, which has some of the biggest shows on TV, right? So it sort of does matter what show that you put after The Big Bang Theory, which mm-hmm. is one of the biggest sitcoms on TV, or it does matter what shows you put after NCIS, which, you know, the new shows are going to debut after those, because CBS, which gets a much older audience than the other networks, knows that it can rely somewhat. I mean, it's not the way it used to be, but it can rely somewhat on those well-established shows to at least give those other shows a fighting chance in terms of being launched. But this is a much older audience. You know, a place like Fox, which for a while was trying to go for a younger audience with sitcoms like New Girl and The Mindy Project, saw that that was not a working model. So is there an audience? Yes, but it is more fractured and more split than ever. That's why we've been defining success downward every year for the past few years. There's so many cable networks, especially this summer, they're launching new shows, right, that mm-hmm. have never really launched shows before, because they know that things are getting nicher, things are getting smaller. If they can move into that, then they can find their audience, their corner of the market. It's not going to be mass, but it's going to be something.
So no mass, so is there no such thing as the mega hit anymore?
I think one thing that's actually interesting about the current crazy television landscape is that the more fragmented it gets, in some sense, the more important blockbuster hit programs are.
Mm-hmm.
If you read Anita Alberzi, she's a professor at the Harvard Business School. She had a great book out last year called The Blockbuster Effect, which was just about this dynamic that whether it's movies or music or television, the more options there are, the more people tend to cluster around the most popular options out there. And so you see that it's more of a winner-take-all market. I mean, that's why Taylor Swift is so huge in music these days. I mean, there still are really huge hit TV programs, whether it's, you know, Game of Thrones or...
I was going to say Empire this year.
Empire. I mean, there are still, you know, Walking Dead on AMC. The difference, though, is that I think it's much harder for sort of the middle of the road. It's harder to have sort of middle-level hits. Because those audiences are getting drawn either to, you know, more very, very, very niche titles out there, and, you know, what was, I guess, once called the long tail, or they're getting pulled into the, you know, the big, you know, Walking Dead, Empire, Game of Thrones monster hits.
And even those monster hits are so much smaller than maybe they would have been 20 years ago.
Right.
You mentioned something earlier, Matthew, about ratings. Not that they didn't matter, but they're no longer as dependable. Do they still matter? You know, now that a show that's canceled for poor ratings could have a life elsewhere.
Yeah, well, The Mindy Project is a perfect example. It wasn't doing well on Fox. By Fox's standards, I think it was averaging somewhere in the 3 million, you know, around 3 million. But Hulu picked it up. For Hulu, I think it was probably a great decision. For them, it will probably be, by their definition, a blockbuster. The people I know are all starting to build their own, you know, cable services in a way. I mean, they're cutting the cord and they're getting HBO Go. If you're a real sports fan, it's probably more complicated. But, you know, if you want to pick show by show and build an a la carte situation for yourself, you really can pretty much do it. And Slate has a great page where you can go and fill in how much you're paying for your cable, what shows you like to watch, and kind of it will help you decide whether you want to cut the cord and whether you can save money by just building your own situation.
That was Matthew Gilbert, the Boston Globe TV critic, also with us, Felix Gillette from Bloomberg Businessweek, and New York Times TV editor Gilbert Cruz. We're talking about the current state of television, whatever that may be. We're talking about the state of TV today. Has it really gasped its last breath in the splintering of audiences and several different carriers and platforms and choices for television? Or are we experiencing a television revival? Or is it a little bit of both? And with us is Felix Gillette from Bloomberg Businessweek, also Boston Globe TV critic Matthew Gilbert, and the New York Times TV editor Gilbert Cruz. Now, Matthew, we just left off with you talking about how people are cutting the cord and creating their own on-demand television experience. Cable's no longer necessary. But, you know, still, that takes time. It takes energy to find things. Are we imagining a day where we will have something like, you know, Apple's new Beat service? We'll need a video curator to tell us what to be watching on television because the choices are so plentiful.
I think we're going to need TV critics.
Well,
right?
You just happen to have a really appreciative audience for that,
yeah.
Right here.
I mean, I kid, but there's truth to that. I mean, I think people, with the proliferation of TV outlets and with all of the quality TV shows that are out there, viewers are really having to look to critics to find out what it is they might want to watch. You know, it's shocking to me how many times I'll tell somebody about a show like Catastrophe or Transparent on Amazon Prime, both of which are really good shows and, you know, haven't really kind of spread to the mainstream yet.
It's made the TV recap a kind of essential piece of reading for me. In fact, we were joking about creating a podcast called Recap, where we would recap television recaps.
It's a good idea. And there's so many good writers out there, you know, recapping these shows and making, you know, in some cases, and I would argue True Detective is a good example, in some cases they're actually making more of the show than I think is really in the show. But in many cases, they're really just leading viewers into greater understanding of what they're seeing, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I don't think we can talk about television this week without talking about True Detective in its second season now. So it's a completely different cast, completely different setting, completely different story than the first True Detective, with so many of us that just had such fun following along and picking out all of the little arcane details and watching the characters. You looking at your Twitter feed, Matthew Gilbert, you're not liking True Detective so much. How about the others? Anyone have a verdict on its increasingly, I guess, David Lynchian feel?
Yes, I have an opinion. And my opinion is mixed to negative. And I think there are some things worth remembering you know, last year with Season One True Detective, which a lot of people fell in love with at a certain point, it wasn't, as I recall, paying attention to Twitter and paying attention to the chatter of people around me, it wasn't until the fourth episode, the one with that tracking shot that everyone lost their mind over, that people really, really started getting into True Detective. So we just finished episode 3, one more to go, let's see what happens. So I'm reserving judgment a little bit, but with the first 3 episodes, somewhat disappointed. And the reason is a very simple reason. We've seen L.A. so many times that just doesn't feel new in the way that the first season's mix of bayou weirdness and supernatural overtones and the over-philosophical musings of Matthew McConaughey, that was just like this weird mix that we hadn't seen before. Whereas this stuff is very familiar in ways that are pleasing to some people and not pleasing other people. There's some David Lynch there. There's some Raymond Chandler there. There's some Chinatown there. You know, it's all stuff that we have seen before in some way. And there are just some weak acting links as well. I don't know what you guys think, but Vince Vaughn is not doing it for me.
I miss Matthew McConaughey.
The words don't feel right in Vince Vaughn's mouth. They just don't.
Yeah, it feels totally ungrounded. Like, even just the supporting characters, the mayor of the town just seems so unreal.
No. Do not. He is my favorite character
on
TV this summer. I want to see so much more of him in every episode. I've never seen a man as drunk as he. Just the way he does. He's fantastic. He's this British actor. You can't even really tell he's British. Other than the fact that he sort of has a different accent in every episode, like in one episode he was doing like a Marlon Brando Godfather thing, he's amazing. I mean, he's ridiculous, but he's amazing.
Well, here, Gilbert, as a tribute to you, is Richie Koster playing the mayor in season 2 of True Detective. The season is called The Western Book of the Dead.
You are industrious, Frank. I want to see you make it through this.
Who wants to move on the poker room?
Kickback's an extra 15 next week, Frank. $22.50 the week after. You don't come through then. I have to entertain other interests.
Business.
Sure.
All right, so rather, other than the mayor of Vinci, California, from True Detective, what are you excited about right now on television?
I'm really excited about the return of Rectify, which is this week on Thursday night. It's such a thoughtful and thought-provoking show about a guy who was in jail for 19 years on death row for a murder that he admitted to under pressure. And finally, after 19 years, he's let free because of new DNA evidence, but he's never exonerated. So he goes back home to this small town in Georgia, and it's fascinating, and it's a slow drama, kind of like Breaking Bad. I mean, the scenes are long, and it really brings you into the moment of the show.
Anyone else excited about anything on television?
I can keep going. Yeah,
I'm excited for a show that is 5 episodes in. It's called Unreal on Lifetime.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Which we just did a feature on. It's essentially a drama that takes place behind the scenes of a bachelor type show, so a reality dating show like the one on ABC. And it's dark. By watching this, you can understand reality shows, I feel like, in a way that you normally wouldn't. It's amazing. It's great. It's probably the best thing that Lifetime has ever done, other than the Saved by the Bell movie. that's exciting.
I completely agree with you. I you know, there are so many shows out there now that are making fun of reality TV.
Well, you know, are the days numbered for reality TV? Something maybe people have been predicting for a long time.
I think it's just more challenging now. I think that whole genre of just, I mean, I was thinking about this as I was writing the story about Viacom and some of MTV's problems, that, you know, MTV with the Osbournes in particular really was one of the leaders of pioneering the genre of reality television that had celebrities or people you knew in one context and then showing them in sort of domestic settings. I feel like that genre, particularly with just the amount of social media and access to celebrities that's just feels saturated. And it seems like now you need something more. You need like more of an ironic take on letting the audience know that you're somewhat, you're in on the joke too. Yeah. I think those straight reality shows are having a harder time breaking through.
I feel like networks that really jumped in big time for reality TV, including NBC and MTV, sort of woke up from this dream and realized that they lost a lot of momentum. And now they're starting to turn back to scripted dramas. And MTV, you notice, is really churning them out. And I think Scream, which premiered last week, did fairly well for them. So maybe that will start a new wave of successful scripted drama for MTV. I hope so.
Well, if cord cutting or on-demand or nonlinear platforms is what is defining the television experience now, where is it going next? Any predictions?
5-minute shows on YouTube. I feel like younger family members of mine don't watch TV in the same ways that I do, and I'm in my 30s, right? So they turn on Netflix when they go home, and that is their cable, essentially. Mm. It's like, what am I going to watch on Netflix tonight? Mm. And if they don't do that, then they're watching, I don't know, web series on YouTube.
Yeah, it's fascinating to go back and watch, you know, old episodes of The Dick Van Dyke Show or The Twilight Zone and see just how slowly they move and how, you know, they luxuriate in time.
I was watching some of the Twilight Zone over the 4th of July. They have, you know, the sci-fi Twilight Zone marathon, and it is one of my favorite shows.
Oh, me too.
You're absolutely right. When you watch that after having seen even half-hour shows now, it takes forever.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. I think if you want to boggle your mind, anyone over the age of 30 should go on to YouTube and watch PewDiePie, an episode of his show. I mean, here's a guy who's now become the most popular artist in the world on YouTube. And he basically, his whole shtick is playing video games and providing sort of play-by-play commentary over it. It is insanely popular, and it is so baffling to me what it is that these kids love about it. But it is. It's a totally different genre. It's one that didn't exist when I was a teenager, certainly.
It's amazing because so many industries are in between models. You know, as somebody who works for a newspaper, I can vouch for that. And I think TV, it's the same thing. I mean, where will this all end up? It will end up somewhere, but it's so hard to figure out what is going to dominate ultimately.
A glimpse of television past, present, and future. Thank you so much for joining us. We last heard from Matthew Gilbert, Boston Globe TV critic. Matthew, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
And also with us, the New York Times TV editor, Gilbert Cruz. Thank you, Gilbert.
That was great. Thanks.
And Felix Gillette from Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And we have links to read the Twitter feeds and more articles by all of our guests at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please pass it along and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
Thank you.